Welcome to Across the Dietary Universe, a podcast where we bring experts along our voyage to discover the secrets of food and how it relates to each of our unique dietary profiles. From the origins of diets to current eating trends to the frontier of food innovation and the future of how we eat, we'll discover that when it comes to food, things are not necessarily as they seem. Honeycomb is a mobile app that works with your iPhone or Android device to help you find suitable food to eat at restaurants near you based on your specific dietary requirements. Pre-order Honeycomb today at get.honeycomb.ai.
All right, Larissa, thank you so much for coming on the Across the Dietary Universe podcast. Obviously, we spoke a few weeks ago and it was really exciting to chat. And I was basically saying, you know what, we just need to get you on the podcast and record this conversation so it doesn't go to waste. Thanks so much for being here, Larissa.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to dive into whatever you have planned for this conversation.
So just a quick introduction for Larissa. Larissa Pop is a certified holistic health coach, functional nutrition counselor, world traveler, and picky eater turned global and bizarre food lover. She loves educating others about functional medicine, detox, and gut health. Larissa specializes in root cause resolution using an individualized full body systems approach to help her clients improve their health and energy. She's found that getting back to the basics is what most people need in order to improve their health, but they just need guidance and accountability to prioritize and make the right habits stick. Welcome. What an introduction. There's so much.
Thank you.
There's so much to unpack in that. I mean, global and bizarre food lover. You know, the thing that stands out to me is initially, and by the way, the connection, just so our audience knows, is my girlfriend's sister has sort of a history with you in terms of a holistic health coach relationship to some degree. And I was talking to her about, we want our AI to be better at predicting gut health outcomes in, you know, when dining out to eat. And she's saying, you know what, you need to talk to an expert at that, Larissa. And so that's sort of how this all came together. But the thing that really caught my attention about you, Larissa, is that you're able to travel around the world and be so conscious of what you're eating and making your body feel right. Because most of the memories that I have of traveling around the world, and I say memories because who's really done that lately, but most of the memories that I have don't really relate to good experiences with eating food outside because I have a gut condition. So how do you balance adding good things to your body, but actually not knowing what is even out there to eat?
Yeah, well, I'd say like the first part of my world travels, I wasn't so health conscious. And so I would just eat anything from the street stalls. I had a really strong stomach. So fortunately, I didn't have any issues with that. But I, you know, then became a health coach and became more conscious. And I spent a lot of time traveling. And then I actually lived in Iraq for 4+ years. I'm now in Turkey, but I was in Iraq the last 4 years. And that was probably the most challenging because it was the first time I started having gut issues with the food. And then my husband, he's Kurdish, Iraqi. And so it was this balance of how do you enjoy the culture and eat the local food, but still you want to feel good. And it was a balance of sometimes eating out, but knowing, kind of becoming familiar with the cuisine so you know how to make smarter choices. But then also I'm the person that sometimes just brings my own salad. Right. Maybe I'll still have the meat, but I bring some salad to have with it. And then also when I visit my in-laws, coming prepared so that I'm not just eating whatever my mother-in-law cooks,
yeah,
but I'm balancing and having some of her food with some of my food.
Right. So you're being very particular and intentional about, you know, what's going into your body. I think everyone wants to know about your experience in Iraq. That is probably something that's very common. I mean, you just don't hear about it too often. You hear, unfortunately, you know, Iraq is painted as, you know, a place that, you know, if you have to go, then go. But no one's really trying to go there because of the volatility, you know, in that entire region. So politics aside, how is the experience from the lens of, you know, being on the ground, being with the people, in you know, whichever cities you were in, and How's the food life there? And what's the culture like?
So I lived in the northern Kurdistan region. So okay. Kurdistan, for those who don't know, it's really an autonomous region of Iraq. So it really has its own culture, and it's more developed and safer than the rest of Iraq. And so I was working, doing humanitarian work with an NGO while I was doing health coaching on the side, although now I'm doing it full time. But really, it wasn't like what I expected or what, you know, my mom worried about. It was really, I think, even safer than me living where I did in DC when I lived in the States. I mean,
wow.
In DC, you can hear gunshots there. I never heard gunshots or had incidents. I mean, things happen, but nothing targeted at me. And then, yeah, in terms of the culture and food, you know, in the like smaller towns, villages, like my in-laws, for them, like my mother-in-law, like hates to go to a restaurant. You know, everything's just home cooked.
Right.
But of course, in the cities now, you know, you have more restaurants and there's expat community. So, you know, there's a bit more options for the expat community. But yeah, sometimes we would drag my mother-in-law to a restaurant and she just hated it. And it's true because she's like, my food is better. My food is cleaner.
Right.
Why do I want to eat in a restaurant? You know, one of the things for me was it was just hard. Their culture, they love meat and chicken is like the best food ever. So when I decided to stop eating chicken, when I heard that a lot of chickens, the way they're raised, what they're fed, given antibiotics and such, I decided I'm going to stop eating chicken there because I'm not sure, you know, if it's organic, what they use. But it was just something they couldn't accept, they couldn't understand. And so it was also that balance. And I think a lot of people struggle with when they make dietary changes, you know, other people kind of not understanding or accepting it. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times they kept trying to force me to eat the chicken. And they would say, but we cooked it in a healthier way. You know, we didn't use a ton of oil. It's just grilled, you know, we put all these spices. It's really good. Just try it. Just try it. Because
right.
My husband just wasn't translating what I wanted to tell them
because
he didn't want to say the reason that I wasn't.
He didn't want to offend them.
But there were also good things. Like I never ate liver until I moved there. And now I eat liver because it's an incredibly nutrient dense food. As long as it's
liver of what?
Well-raised
liver
animal.
Of which animal?
I like from sheep or lamb. So I find it tastes the least livery, kind of the best taste.
Interesting. I, as a kid, sometimes my dad would bring home liver and he's like, this is so nutritious. You should try it. And it's about the worst thing I've ever tasted. Is this an acquired taste that you need to go through the process of hating it before you love it? Or did you love it immediately?
Yeah, sure. Maybe. I know. I think first time I had chicken liver, I hated it.
Right.
Didn't like it. But then for me, when I hear about the health benefits of something, I'll give it another chance. And so really, my history where I say I went from a meat eater to a global and bizarre food lover.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, I really, there were so many foods I didn't like, but I just, it was really like when I lived in Japan, because that was my first, well, China and Japan were kind of my first two international experiences, that I just wanted to embrace the culture. And so I kind of forced myself to eat new foods. And then I realized, okay, if you eat something enough times, often you can acquire a taste for it. But you also have to learn how to cook it in the right way. So that's what I found with liver. You got to cook it in the right way. And then it still tastes like liver, but you can make it taste more palatable. And so it's kind of something I eat once a week just for the health benefits.
Do you think... So just to take this in a different direction with the liver, because we have plant-based equivalents for like a burger now, right? We have like Beyond Meat, we have plant-based, there's in Vancouver, there's a really cool plant-based hot dog restaurant that opened up called Good Dogs, that they taste amazing. But do you think it's eventually going to evolve into like specific cuts and specific organs, like the liver, for example? A plant-based liver, is it possible to replicate the health benefits in a plant-based form, or is that we're not quite there yet? That's maybe a bit away.
Yeah, I mean, Because essentially, I mean, if it's plant-based, you're not going to grind up and stick some liver in it. It would just be adding in
probably not
certain nutrients, you know, like the nutrients you get from liver.
What makes it nutritious?
So liver is just packed with B vitamins, especially folate and B12, lots of iron, zinc, vitamin A, which is especially important for our gut lining. So just, yeah, really nutrient dense. And then also, if you look at kind of Chinese medicine, they believe that if you eat certain parts of the body, it's also good for that part of your body. So it would mean that eating liver supports your own liver.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then it's also like very lean, so it's low in fat as well and good source of protein.
The liver is not necessarily about the taste. It's about the nutrition. To be clear,
you could add those certain nutrients. Like, for example, a lot of people need more vitamin A to support gut health, as one example.
You mentioned vitamin A. And so is that something that anyone with any gut issue, like IBS, IBD, is that something that we should be checking sort of in our intake of food?
So my approach, I mean, with functional nutrition is that, and even like, you know, because I started off as a health coach and then I ended up also studying functional nutrition to go deeper. And so it's really looking at first adding in more nutrient dense foods in general. So like, I don't start off by getting like really specific about eating this food, that food for these specific nutrients, unless I'm doing a detox, but just lots of diversity. Having like a lot of diversity in your diet with a lot of nutrient dense foods. And then if people are still having symptoms when we do that and we address some other kind of foundations, then we look at testing and, you know, even some standard blood tests and see, you know, what might be kind of deficient or what imbalances there might be.
Got it. So based on each individual, and this is, of course, the common theme and the common theme across the podcast, we've talked to many nutrition and health experts, and it's always, you know, it always comes down to taking a look at what is deficient in a person and seeing what is their gut biome look like, what is their exact needs and what is important for their specific situation. So it makes sense that you want to look at the data first before making a recommendation. So I guess step one would be see where you're deficient, you know, run some tests, connect with a health coach and see. But typically it sounds like from your experience, vitamin A is a warning sign. You know, if it's a bit low, is that what you're saying?
It's not something that's usually tested. It's just from all the research and my education, it's something that most people, if they're having gut issues, will benefit from having more of. But of course, it is one of the fat-soluble vitamins, so you need to be careful about supplementing just like you would with any fat-soluble vitamin. That's why, again, I think food is best, but of course not everyone, not just liver, but some people obviously just don't eat meat.
Right. I want to take a step back for a second. So obviously I want to talk about energy. I want to talk about detoxing. I want to get into the nuance. And I have some other interesting topics to cover as well. But before we jump into those, you worked for, you know, I don't just want to brush this aside, but you worked for, you know, an international nonprofit. And while you were doing that, you were saying you started part-time to work towards being a health coach. When did that transition happen? When did you decide, I'm going to take this on part-time? And then how did you end up becoming full-time? Because it's a pretty significant career change.
So I was never really conscious about my health growing up. I mean, my mom fed me well-balanced meals. Like, she made sure I ate broccoli, even though she hated it and wouldn't touch it. And didn't have a ton of fast food, but still, I was like a typical American kid. I still like to eat Oreos and have, you know, Fruit Loops and some fast food. And, you know, I just didn't have any issues with weight. So I think it's that belief a lot of people have that, okay, if your weight is fine, then your health is fine, you know, and I was also always involved in sports. But then, you know, as you start to get older and then a bit more sedentary lifestyle, things changed. It was actually when I moved to Japan, I was an English teacher there, that suddenly I started gaining weight. And I thought, oh, I guess I can't just eat donuts all the time and all this other stuff that I was consuming. So it really, it wasn't, I had some big health challenge, but I started to become a little more aware of my nutrition. And honestly, I was on this journey of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I studied biology. I thought I wanted to be physical therapist and then a pharmacist and then a doctor. And then I really didn't know. I became an English teacher for a period. But then I met a health coach, and I'd never heard of health coaching, but when she talked about it, it was just like, that's it. Like, this is what I want to do with my life. This is kind of what I've been waiting for. And then the more that I went down that route, I started health coaching on the side while I was doing the humanitarian work, which I also enjoyed, but it wasn't the same. But the more and more I just learned about the power of food as medicine and just how much we can control our health destiny and reverse symptoms and disease with food, and then studying functional nutrition, which is, you know, based on the functional medicine model. It just, again, it just fascinates me. And so I was just spending all my free time studying, researching. And so I finally, at the end of, right before COVID hit, so it was kind of good timing, I decided that I was just going to finally take it full time. And it was a good point with my work that I was finishing up with a project and also ready to leave Iraq.
Good for you. So it sounds like you channeled your, the urge to be a humanitarian and to help people into, you know, specific one-on-one, like let's help people's health and their food and their diet, and that could ultimately give them a better outcome in their life. And so it's humanitarian in that sense. And it's cool how you're able to,
right,
sort of like the same mission almost.
And yeah. And then actually I ended up, some of my clients were other humanitarian workers that I met in Iraq. And I remember, so one of them actually, when we had a call, you know, before we started working together, she was feeling really guilty about spending the money on a health coach, you know, when there's all these poor families that, you know, that money could help, you know, to give them how many meals.
Right.
And so what I said to her was, like, if you keep going the way you are now, you're going to burn out and then you can't help anyone. Like, I think I see so many of these humanitarian workers that really they're not taking care of their health because they're so focused on taking care of others, but then they do burn out and they have to take months off of work and they just can't help anyone. So it's also just, yeah, convincing people that they have to make their health a priority and that by taking care of themselves, they can better take care of others.
Right. I think that's very sound advice for anyone in any career field, really, because you just end up 100% burning out. If you're going to the gym, you have to rest the body, right? And it's the same thing with anything else. You're going to go too hard, and then you're going to pay the price for it. And a lot of times you don't necessarily pay the price to the full degree immediately in the short term. You pay for it in the long term. One day, maybe you don't have small things that happen, but then it accumulates into a huge bad thing that could happen 10 years down the line. And at that point, it's too late, right? So I think it's very important to take care of the body, take care of the engine, the machinery, keep it oiled and have it work properly. And it's really good because a lot of times in life, people try to reinvent the wheel. I'm guilty of this too. I say, you know what? I could figure it out myself. YouTube exists. These days, like with YouTube, everybody thinks they're the expert in everything. And even on these podcasts, like you listen to a few podcasts and all of a sudden you're an expert on a topic. But the truth is, it's like you're very much just scratching the surface. And it's really useful to connect with a professional. It doesn't even have to be across a large, you know, large or long period of time. It's simply just to know where your blind spots are, right? And to connect with someone like you, for example, and they can say, hey, you know what? You should be doing that and not that. And it may have never occurred to you. So it's, I think, very important to take a step back and say, hey, what is actually going on here? And do I have the longevity to achieve my goals and not just think of the next 30 days, 60 days, 90 days?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to ask you, so you focus as a health coach on energy. And to me, that's sort of like the main metrics, like how much energy do I have in a day? Do I have enough energy to accomplish all the things that I do? Oh, wait, it turns out if I have like a full bowl of oatmeal in the morning, I'm going to crash in about 2 hours and I'm going to have less energy. So talk to me about how energy plays a part, because I'm very interested in that.
Yeah. So I use a few different frameworks. So I've shifted a little, like from the approach I took, you know, just with my health coach training to when I studied functional nutrition, I was introduced to a number of frameworks that I think make it even easier to address anything. So whether it's someone who's just, you know, relatively healthy, but they're, you know, not having kind of stable energy and having that afternoon energy slump, or someone that has chronic fatigue and, you know, more serious issue, I would take the same approach. So I really look at kind of what I call like three tiers. So first we have our non-negotiables. Like, what are those things that really we have to remove from the diet or add in that are just essential for optimal health? Because it's really no different if we're looking at energy or some other health goal. And so it might be, again, identifying food sensitivities, you know, like I'm sure you've spoken about a lot. For me, I realized that gluten just makes me feel really tired after a meal. It could be removing toxins. So I focus a lot on detox because toxins can also impair mitochondria function. And then, you know, optimizing gut health. So there's a lot of talk, obviously, about the gut-brain axis. So there's also a gut microbiome mitochondrial axis that, interestingly, when our mitochondria have a demand for energy, they send a signal to the microbiome, which then releases compounds for it to produce energy. And interesting thing I learned about that recently is that at the same time it's doing that, it also propagates certain bacteria that improve metabolism. So if you do 8 to 20 minutes of movement before a meal, it's actually better, both for gut health. If you have leaky gut, it'll reduce the toxicity of that meal.
So that's how you optimize that process?
Yeah, so
you get the body moving?
Yeah, so this is something you may be familiar with, Kiran Krishnan. So I follow him a lot. He's a microbiome expert and founder of the Microbiome Labs. So this is something I learned from him recently. So really interesting just how the gut microbiome connects to everything in the body. So it, you know, always comes back to optimizing our gut microbiome because it makes everything else function better. But then I want to come back to the basics. So like you said, okay, in my introduction, you know, what I found is that people often overlook the basics. And so digestion, when we think about energy, like digestion is like a huge energy zapping process. That's why people eat a big meal and they feel tired afterwards. And a simple thing that we all need to be doing and we're not is chewing our food really well. That when you chew your food really well, it breaks it down into really small pieces. So then the rest of the digestive process is a lot easier. It also mixes it with, you know, our enzymes. And it's so simple, but like, it's something like when I work with clients, I have to constantly be reminding them of it. And it's powerful for improving our gut health and energy.
I mean, with so many things, we don't really want a simple solution, right? We want the exotic solution. We want you to tell us, like, eat this type of mushroom with your food and all of your worries and problems will go away. It reminds me of, you know, all these stories and tales of people going to gurus and they're looking for like the meaning of life or how do I attain enlightenment, whatever. And they get them to do all these different tasks and stuff. And at the end of the day, it's never about the task. The answer is very simple. Chewing your food. It's something that I probably don't really pay attention to. And I probably swallow faster than I should. I just chew a bit and then I'm like, it's okay. The gut will take care of it. But you don't even think about it. You're just lazy. It's kind of annoying to chew more than, you know, what's necessary for you not to choke.
Right. And it takes more time. Most people, they're not sitting down and they're multitasking. But it's also essential because, again, digestion, if we don't optimize digestion, we don't get all the nutrients from our food. And that's the other thing that impacts energy, you know, having enough nutrients. When we have deficiencies, like a lot of people have iron deficiency, a lot of people, like women these days, are hypothyroid, low thyroid function, and that comes from nutrient deficiencies, and that's affecting energy. And so rather than first go to supplements, let's get all the maximum nutrition we can extract from our food. Mm-hmm. And it starts with like chewing. Well, of course, like people can benefit from digestive enzymes and other support, but let's not forget the basics. But if you do want something, maybe someone wants that food, like what's the like food that I can just eat and have more energy? Because I'm not a fan of caffeine. I don't, I mean, I have chocolate or like raw cacao, but I don't do coffee or tea. Actually, nothing against that. But if people want to get energy from like coffee, they really need to cycle it, not be on it every day, but take periods where they cycle it, because otherwise what happens is you have this baseline energy level. But when you start to like constantly be having coffee, your energy goes up, but it's no longer coming to the baseline energy. It's now your baseline is down here. So then when you have that coffee, you're really now just going up to your prior baseline level of energy. And so you really
need to
be
a tolerance,
cycling and taking a few days off.
Because a tolerance is being built. All right.
Yeah, I mean, I learned this from, I did a whole training with Ari Witten, who specializes in energy. And yeah, it's something to do with receptors in our brain. And it's, so aside from that, like what I use for energy, aside from cacao, which is also caffeine, is maca. So I recently became a huge fan of maca, which is an adaptogen that comes from Peru. Do you know maca?
I've heard of maca. I drink a lot of matcha, but that's not the same thing.
Yeah. So maca is a root, and basically it's sold as a powder. So you're not going to find a whole maca root in the grocery store, but it's a powder. And so adaptogens are really helpful, and maca is in particular really helpful for energy. And the great thing about it as an adaptogen, you know, it can give you energy boost in the morning when you need it. But even if you take it in the evening, it's not going to keep you from sleeping, because it's really just bringing balance to your body and giving it what it needs. So it can give you energy, or it can kind of help you relax.
Is that something,
I found that for me and so many people, that maca really helps.
Is that something you can take every day, or you have to cycle that as well?
So I've been taking it every day, but I think, I believe like any sort of supplements, and I would consider this still kind of like a supplement to my diet, I think it's always good to cycle and take some days off just for your body to take a break from anything, I think is good.
So this might be a dumb question, but for the last couple of years, I've been having a ton of coffee because I found out that Nespresso machines exist. And so I got one at home, I got one for the office, and it was amazing. But with my, whenever I have a flare up with my colitis, it's really not a good idea to be having a coffee, especially espresso. Like it basically is like gasoline just running through your body. It's not really conducive to putting the gut in a situation where it's going to heal from a flare-up very quickly. Mm-hmm. So typically in a flare-up, I'll stop having coffee. But what I've done now in my, you know, getting into remission again, as I started to have matcha. Now, it's still not, they're obviously both caffeine, but I wonder, is there a benefit from switching like the caffeine source in terms of like the tolerance level or how my body's reacting to it? Or is it essentially the same thing with a different flavor?
Well, it's not exactly the same, because matcha has components that are really, I mean, coffee also has components that are good. We get antioxidants from both, but green tea in particular, really supportive of detoxification processes. And so definitely I think matcha is even better than coffee in that regard, but the caffeine would be the same. I mean, matcha really has a lot of caffeine compared to just a regular brewed green tea.
Right.
But I mean, it's still diversity. You're still getting some different phytochemicals, you know, some different antioxidants.
Right.
So I think that's good.
Cool. All right. Plus one. Plus
that brings
one
up
me.
A good point. But I guess I want to make another point with energy, is that if we're having low energy, not that there's anything wrong with it from time to time, but if like someone is in the habit of like they have low energy, they have some sort of caffeinated beverage and then they keep going. Again, it's not listening to their body and what their body needs. And so I really always encourage my clients and my audience, like, let's listen to our body and it's giving us signals and we have to pay attention, because otherwise it's just the same as, you know, a pill for an ill, you know, taking a pain medication. And we really need to address like what's going on under there. And maybe it's just that we need more sleep, because again, that's another basic thing that people overlook that is so, so, so important, is right. getting enough sleep, and not just 8 hours of sleep, but what are those 8 hours? You know, it's not the same if you go to bed at midnight or 1 a.m. and get 8 hours. You really want to be in bed no later than 11 to optimize, you know, your sleep quality.
And that's because, you know, you want it to be somewhat connected to like sunrise, sunset. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, to optimize your circadian rhythm. And then there's also, again, I don't study this a lot, but, you know, my brother lives in China, so I became somewhat interested in Chinese medicine and the Chinese meridians, you know, for different organs, there's different times they're active. So the liver, again, I focus on detoxification between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m., the liver is most active. And so that's why you'd want to sleep no later than 11, so that you're able to get into a deep sleep by 1 a.m. so your liver can be doing its work, because we do most of the detoxification and kind of restoring our body while we're sleeping. Also, I heard, what's his name? He's like this famous sleep doctor now. Starts with a B. Anyways, He talks about like sleep chronotypes. He has a quiz about your sleep chronotype. But he said that for every hour of sleep before midnight, it's equal to 3 hours of sleep after midnight. So that like any hour of sleep before midnight is three times more restorative than sleep after midnight. So again, it's just, yeah, being in sync with the circadian rhythm. And
right. That makes sense.
There's a lot to it with.
That makes sense. Just a quick note on Chinese medicine, because, you know, I think a lot of people are maybe, especially, you know, in North America, they're perhaps on the fence. They don't really know what to make of Chinese medicine. Now, you know, people in China might look at North America and say, well, you know, we're so unhealthy. We're not in tune with our bodies. You know, we're overweight. We're this, we're that. We have any number of problems. But people in the West, people in North America might say, well, you know, this is not necessarily like as science-backed as possible. You know, I don't know if we agree with this. How do you reconcile those two ideas? Because I don't really know what to make of Chinese medicine. I know that I'd go to Chinatown with my dad as a kid, and he'd get, you know, any number of things for his sports injuries, and they would work and they'd be great. So, you know, how do you approach this? How do you look at Chinese medicine?
I mean, I think it's worth trying, you know, because again, the approach that I take is, you know, we're all unique. There's no one size fits all. There's no perfect diet. I mean, we just have to try things. And so if someone wants to try Chinese medicine and then you see if it works, you know, because the protocol that I use with clients is like assess, recommend, track. You know, I do a really thorough assessment. Based on that, I recommend, you know, a few things we track. So whether you're taking things from Chinese medicine or from Ayurvedic medicine, I mean, I think we can learn a lot from these traditions that have been around for a long time, but still have to see what works for the individual. I don't know, my brother, it's interesting because he's married to, his wife is Chinese. And so she kind of goes more towards the Western medicine and he's more towards the Chinese medicine. And, you know, so he had something wrong and he went and the doctor gave him this like huge centipede like this and said, I want you to like boil this with some other things into a tea and drink it.
Wow.
I mean, some things he feels helps, other things he doesn't really notice the difference, but he's open to try.
Yeah. How would you feel about the centipede situation? Would you boil the centipede?
Yeah, I would. So like I said, I mean, I like healthy food, but I also like bizarre foods from my travels, especially traveling through Southeast
Asia.
That's
true. That's very bizarre.
I mean, I've eaten like I did a homestay in Cambodia, and actually they caught crickets, like these big crickets from outside, and we had those as a nice snack with a few beers. And
yeah, I mean, I've seen the cricket snack here actually in Vancouver at a couple stores. So people are definitely eating them, and there's nothing wrong with them. It's just a cultural thing. It's like, well, why is a cricket any different than, I don't know, like a pig, for example, right? Like, it's any living mm-hmm. creature at the end of the day. It's like, well, if you're eating one, there's no real reason why you can't eat this other thing, even though it's a bit smaller. What was the strangest thing that you've eaten in your travels? I'm curious now.
Strangest thing could be, I don't even know what it was. I remember this thing I had in China once that it was like a dessert, and it was like a small papaya, and in it, it had this, I don't know what it was. It was like frog, something from inside the frog. I don't even know. There's some things in both Japan and China I ate. I didn't know. But the worst thing, I think, was the stinky tofu. The stinky tofu in China was just awful.
Is it called stinky tofu?
Is
that the name of the dish, stinky tofu?
Yeah, it's fermented for a very long time, and it smells awful, and it. I thought if I plug my nose and try it, it might be better. It wasn't, but people like it. And again, I respect like every culture, and that's why I'm willing to try anything if, you know, it's part of a local cuisine.
What's the difference between a detox and a cleanse?
Detox and a cleanse. I mean, so these phrases are used really interchangeably. And the way that I distinguish it is like a detox is, I mean, really the first part of a detox is just removing your exposure to toxins as much as possible. But then it's bringing in specific support, like nutrients that are needed to optimize your liver's detoxification pathways. And because we have two pathways in the liver, and they need specific nutrients. So detox is something we do on a daily basis. But when I say do a detox, like I lead a group through a detox, it's like bringing in more of those foods with the specific nutrients to give more support to our liver's detoxification pathways and the other organs that support detoxification. And then a cleanse, I see it as more also just gently supporting the liver to kind of not necessarily like focus on supporting those detox processes, but it's just kind of taking, you know, like a vacation for the liver almost, you know, right. So it has like less work to do and just kind of cleaning up the diet. But there's a lot of overlap in these. So a cleanse kind of includes the detox, but a bit more, because I think some people do a detox, but they don't necessarily fully, you know, because you could take a bunch of detox supplements without really cleaning up your diet and bringing in that extra support for the liver. And so I like to incorporate both of those. So like every quarter I have a seasonal cleanse, and I think it's, you know, detox is something we should do on a daily basis just by eating a lot of those nutrient dense foods like cruciferous vegetables and, you know, as people can tolerate them, garlic and onions, these sulfur rich vegetables are really good. And just making sure that, again, it comes back to just a really, as, you know, of course, people with gut issues, whatever they can tolerate, expanding right. the diversity of their diet, because then we get more nutrients, which we need to support detoxification. And, you know, we have to get rid of toxins also to heal the gut. And we also need a healthy gut to support detoxification. So that's why, you know, they kind of both go hand in hand.
That all sounds super legit. You know, I've seen a lot of people talk about how detoxing and cleansing is not science-based, and there's no evidence to say this or that, but it just seems logical to me that, for example, if you're taking a break from, like, take a break from alcohol, take a break from caffeine, add these better things. It's like an oil change, you know, for one thing, your car needs it, or it's like vacuuming the inside of the car or whatever. Like, it fundamentally, the principles make sense. So I don't really understand what all the controversy is around this. I think if you're putting good things in your body and you're trying to get rid of the bad things, even if it is for a short season, a short period of time, that's probably going to have a better impact than if you never did it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it just depends on what type of detox or cleanse you're doing, because there's a lot out there that aren't really designed well. And so you want to make sure that it's one that you're including all the nutrients that you really need to support those detox processes.
Right. So so maybe where we can, you know, we can make a distinction is some of these juicing companies, for example, that will sell you like a month kit to detox is not the same as reaching out to, you know, a health coach like yourself and actually putting together an individualized plan. Those are sort of, one is a marketing detox and the other one is actually, you know, meant to focus on specific outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there could be benefit for some with that, but again, right. You know, if some person has insulin resistance, blood sugar issues, then they need to be careful with doing like a juice cleanse. It wouldn't be right for everyone. And I like to do mine in a way that I'm also educating people so that, you know, we do this 21-day cleanse, but afterwards they know what they can do on a daily basis or a semi-annual basis to continue to support kind of detoxification.
Right. Yeah, that's brilliant and provides a lot of insight to me, because this is all, you know, the great thing about this podcast, I get to talk to professionals and learn a lot and ask any question that I find interesting that hopefully our audience does. But it's super valuable because I could just pick your brain and get this information and learn along the way.
Just one point I really want to like emphasize with detox is that, again, I always say like the first step of detox is removing your exposure to toxins.
Right.
It's a second step. Remove your exposure to toxins. Third step, remove your exposure to toxins. And then let's start focusing on like digestion and, you know, making sure that we're pooping well and draining, you know, getting the waste out. And then we move on to more advanced things. People, again, let's emphasize the basics that It doesn't help to do some juice cleanse or anything. And then we're just still using these toxic products on our skin every day and taking in so much from our environment.
Wow. Yeah. My cousin, she runs a esthetician. So she runs like a skincare company, and her focus with all the skincare products is to use ones, you know, that don't have toxins in it, that are healthy, that are organic, that are, you know, fundamentally good for your body. So that's really cool that you're saying that's not just necessarily to do with food, but you actually have other ways for toxins, to get in your body, as well. I want to jump into picky eating here before we wrap up, because you're saying that the first time you visited China, your favorite places to eat were McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and KFC. And then eventually when you returned, obviously you tried all the different delicacies like we were talking about in China and Japan. What's your advice for picky eaters who would probably be doing the same thing, but want to try all of these new foods? Like how did you make that transition? And what's your advice for people who want to make it? And what's your advice for people like me? Well, I have like a gut condition. So when I'm in remission, I can take a couple chances. But I also don't want to take too many chances because, you know, who knows what's going to happen. So anyways, I'll leave it to you.
Okay. First, someone has to just have the desire to want to expand the foods that they're eating. You know, they have to be interested. You know, when I first went to China, I wasn't actually that interested in trying the different foods, but I needed to at least find foods that would keep me from being hungry. So I didn't like white rice, but I learned to like white rice because it was going to fill my belly. I didn't like green tea, but it was kind of what they were serving most because, you know, water wasn't as common. So I had to get that so I could hydrate well.
Right.
So for me, it was kind of like a necessity at first. But then when I went to Japan, it was like, okay, let's embrace the culture. It was actually my supervisor at my school said, when you get used to the food, I will invite you over for dinner. And I was just like, that it like hurt.
Yeah.
I was like, interesting. I'm like homesick and you're going to wait. So I said, okay. So I don't know. I think that kind of mentally for me was something that switched and was like, okay, let's be open. I mean, and so I did this homestay one weekend, and the first thing that they had was a barbecue with intestines. And I was, okay, I tried it. It was very, very chewy, and I ended up spitting it out, but I tried it. And so I just decided that I'm going to try anything that they give to me. If I don't like it, okay, but I'm going to try it. And I just learned that the more you taste something, even if you don't like it the first time, just be willing to try it again and sometimes have it cooked differently. Like, I learned to like so many things in Japan, but then olives were still something I hated. But then my sister, she went to California, started eating olives, and she was like a picky eater too. So I was like, how can she like olives? I don't like olives. So I went to Argentina, and they put olives on their pizza always. So like, okay, I'm just going to make myself eat these olives. So again, I would make myself eat them, and the more I ate them,
yeah,
the more I kind of acquired a taste. Because I think they say you need to expose your taste buds 15 times to a new food before your taste buds can decide if they like it. Doesn't mean you'll necessarily like it, but you got to expose your taste buds at least 15 times. And wow. I've tried that on my dad with seaweed, and it didn't work. But for most things, like, it works, and it did work for me. But then when it comes to people like you, you know, if you have some gut issues, sensitive gut, you know, being open, but I think it's more about the portion size, you know, just starting with like smaller amounts. Because usually I think you found that sometimes it's just if you overdo it, you know, sometimes you can take a little bit of something, but if you have too much of that new thing, especially if it's something that's a new vegetable, like I found that in Iraq. I was eating Jerusalem artichoke, a ton of Jerusalem artichokes in this pickled dish my mother-in-law made. And I had so much burping and gas, and I didn't know what it was. And then I learned that Jerusalem artichoke has inulin, which is like, you know, one of the best sources of prebiotic fiber, super high in this prebiotic fiber. And, but my gut like had never been exposed to it. And so it just caused all of this, gas, but then with some time I could end up eating it. I had to train my gut and grow those bacteria that could digest it.
Wow.
So I think, yeah, being open to try things, but slowly increasing.
Well, very, very sound advice, I think. Like the way you approach that small portion size for me, I'm like, that's a really good strategy. I hadn't even thought of that strategy. You know, you order a dish, it's like, well, I have to eat the whole dish. I can't let it go to waste. And the 15 times to be exposed to something, I mean, it's good to know that in advance, because you have to build up the courage, I feel, to go through that many times and to really want to enjoy a culture, and whether it's Japan or China or whatever it might be, whatever picky food you're looking for. I think our audience can know that, you know, even right now, if you're a bit hesitant, there is a path of success. There is a way. If you just try it slowly, slowly, you can maybe acquire that taste, and you'll be exposed to new culture, and you'll be invited over for dinners at people's houses. That's a good one. That's a good one for sure. And it sounds like competition is.
And try it cooked in different ways.
Cooked in different ways, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cooked in different ways. Yeah, my husband was like, I don't like broccoli. But then I cooked broccoli for him, and then he loved it.
Like steamed broccoli? Or
this way.
What did you do to the broccoli?
I like to just do it. I like sauteed in a skillet with just a little bit of oil and garlic, and get it just a little bit browned. And it's really tasty that way. My sister-in-law, she also, like, I cooked it at her house, and her kids, like, they loved it. All her kids were, like, reaching for the broccoli. She was like, you have to give me a recipe.
Yeah.
It's not much of a recipe, but.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So nice.
I'm trying to cook things in different ways.
Yeah, for me, even, like, it's the opposite with certain vegetables. Like, a cooked beet, I don't like, but I'll eat, like, a full raw beet. It's delicious.
Interesting.
So sometimes it's the reverse. When it's not cooked, it's better. Cool. Well, Larissa, it was amazing talking to you. I feel like we could continue talking for quite a while. There's so much to talk about. But for people who want to get more of you beyond this podcast, they should go to your website, larissapopp.com. That's LarissaPopp.com. And also your Instagram, which is POPP Wellness. So Pop Wellness is the user handle. Anything else you want to say for the listeners before we wrap up?
No, but yeah, if you go to my website or the link in my profile on Instagram, I offer a free 45-minute consultation if anyone's interested in speaking to me to see, you know, kind of learn more about what I do and how I might be able to help them.
Awesome. I mean, I totally trust your advice, your expertise. And I have a lot of respect for you, you know, traveling around the world and trying all these things and just being willing to, you know, to take some chances and get all this learning and bring it back for us to listen and learn from. So I really appreciate your time today, Larissa, and I look forward to having a follow-up in the future.
Thanks. I'd love to. Thanks for having me on.